Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And this is This Day in History, October the 4th. On this day in history, in 1626, Richard Cromwell was born on this day, who made the revolution that changed Britain forever. This is the day in 1895, the great American actor, director, and producer Buster Keaton was born. In 1917, Violeta Parra was born, the Chilean singer-songwriter and guitarist who died in 1967 in a suicide, wrote Gracias a la Vida, a song that became famous when other people sang it as well. We'll hear some of that during the course of this hour. She was a revolutionary and a singer, an incredible human being who left the planet much too early. This was the day that Anne Rice, the great American author, was born in 1941, and Bernice Johnson Reagan, American singer-songwriter, founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock, and the Freedom Singers, was born in 1942. Rap Brown was born on this day in 1943, leader of SNCC, now serving a life sentence in prison for a crime he said he did not commit. This was the day in 1946 that now Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel was born, Vietnam veteran. And on this day in 1946 also, Susan Sarandon, a fighter for people's popular causes and great American actress, was born. On this day in 1869, the great painter Rembrandt passed away. And on this day in 1951, you'll learn more about during the course of the show today, Henrietta Lacks, the American patient whose cells became known as HeLa cells, were derived from her cervical cancer, were used as an existing line of cells without her consent, without her family's knowledge. On this day in 1970, the great Janis Joplin died from an overdose, Big Brother and the Holding Company, one of America's great singers. This is the day that Anne Sexton in 1974 died, as did in 1982 Glenn Gould, one of our great pianists. On this day in 1535, the first complete English Bible was written, the Cloverdale Bible, is printed with translations by William Tyndale and Miles Coverdale. This was the day that the Gregorian calendar first came into being in 1582. And in 1824, the Mexico adopts a new constitution, becoming a federal republic, and outlawed slavery. The leader of that rebellion that led to the New Mexico was an Afro-Mexican. This was the day the Crimean War started in 1853 when the Ottoman Empire declared war on Russia. And in 1864, the New Orleans Tribune, first black daily newspaper, was founded by Dr. Louis C. Rudinet. The newspaper, published in both English and French, started as a tri-weekly, but soon became an influential daily. On this day in 1957, Sputnik was launched and the space race began, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth. And on this day in 1988, the Martin Luther King Jr. Federal Building was dedicated in Atlanta. It's the first building in the nation to be named after Martin Luther King, which is wonderful to have all these things and highways named for him, but it also meant that we began to sanitize his image so we could name buildings after him. But at least they named them. So that was this day in history on October the 4th. Now we turn to an interview that Anthony McCarthy, host of The Anthony McCarthy Show on WEAA, and I did with Rebecca Skloot back in 2010 about her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, an African-American woman whose cells were taken without her consent, whose cells became the first immortal cell line, passed away on October the 4th, 1951. And here's that interview. So this is an amazing story. I mean, why don't you just, for our listeners, just give an inkling of what this is? I mean, and how, start with how you became absorbed in the story when you were just a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah. So I'll just do a little bit of background about who Henrietta Lacks was. She was a poor African-American tobacco farmer who grew up in Southern Virginia. And in 1951, she got cervical cancer, went to Johns Hopkins, where she was treated, and without her knowledge, before treating her cancer, her doctor just cut a little piece of her tumor and put it in a dish, which was absolutely standard practice at the time. And though she never knew it, and no one knows entirely why, her cells never died. They became the first immortal human cell line ever grown in culture. And they're still alive today, you know, growing in laboratories around the world almost 60 years after her death. Mm.
And they had a special name.
Yeah, they're called HeLa cells, which is H-E-L-A. And that stands for Henrietta, H-E for Henrietta, and L-A for Lacks. And yeah, they were one of the most important things that happened to medicine. They were used to help develop polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned. Her genes, some of the first ever mapped. So they were this enormously important thing for science. And when I first learned about them when I was 16, in a basic biology class, that was all I knew, was that there were these incredibly important cells, and they came from a woman no one seemed to know anything about. So I sort of became obsessed with them and spent, you know, years and years just sort of trying to track down the story. And what I found was really, in some ways, as much the story of her family as the story of her and the cells. The cells ended up having a pretty painful effects on the family in the long run.
And her family, many of them still live in East Baltimore.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
And you had a difficult time, almost a year spending to convince her daughter to have a conversation with you.
Yeah. When I came along, which was in the late 90s, when I finally got in touch with the family, you know, I was one in a long line of people who essentially come to them wanting something having to do with these cells, and, you know, particularly white people. And they just wanted nothing to do with it. So, yeah, it took about a year and a half to convince them to talk to me and to sort of start winning their trust to be able to tell the story.
Tell the story about how Henrietta's husband, found out about this when they wanted to take his blood sample and the confusion that erupted after that.
Yeah. So her children, she had five kids when she died and a husband, and none of them knew anything about the cells until the early 70s when some scientists decided to track down her kids to do research on them in order to learn more about the cells. And her husband had a third grade education. He didn't really know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day from a scientist. And the way he understood it was, essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. And we've been doing research on parts of her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. They wanted to just do research on the kids. But her husband didn't really understand that. You know, the only kind of cell he'd ever heard of was a prison cell. And initially he thought they had her in the cell. And so her family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't really understand, and no one ever tried to explain it to them. And that's part of what was really difficult for them. For years they were used in research.
Let's go on the phones here, 410-319-8888. We're talking to Rebecca Skloot, her New York Times bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. An incredibly powerful story about the use and abuse of this woman and her family, the complexities of that, and also the hope that this horrendous deed in some ways has given the rest of the world. 410-319-8888. Ben in Owings Mills, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Well.
I guess I'm about to do my $50 pledge, but I just had a quick question. I'm actually a Collins, and I'm my family is actually from Clover, Virginia. That's kind of where the Lack thing, we all related. I'm sure the author has done some background on the family. She'll know a little bit about Clover, Virginia. But, you know, that's something that has been passed down through our family for a while, her story. It's just very interesting to see how something like this could go so far under the radar screen for so long. You know, could she tell me exactly, was it an effort by Johns Hopkins to keep this information quiet?
Yeah, the town that you mentioned that was where Henrietta was raised and where she lived for most of her life. And I spent a lot of time down there doing research on the book. And there's the story of Clover is really sort of part of the book. And you know, when the cells were first taken in the 50s. It was really common to take cells from people and grow them in culture and not tell them. When her cells became so important to science, there was a pseudonym released. So they put it a fake name, Helen Lane. So to this day, most scientists, you know, before the book came out, thought that HeLa cells came from Helen Lane. And that was sort of, you know, a lot of that was an effort to, you know, essentially keep her privacy. You know, so there's, even in the 50s, there wasn't informed consent like we have it today, but they did have this notion that you shouldn't be letting people's medical records out there to the world with their names attached to them, and that there was some kind of privacy. And her cells were all over the world, and initially scientists sort of realized a little after the fact, oops, we probably shouldn't have, you know, released her name and all of her medical information with them. So there was this effort to sort of keep her identity hidden, largely for that reason. And also in the 50s, some journalists got fairly close to finding her kids, Someone had the name Henrietta Lakes, L-A-K-E-S, and then that sort of made some of the scientists nervous that they were actually going to track down her kids, and that was part of releasing the name Helen Lane as well, to sort of throw the journalists off the track of her family. You know, and so there are a lot of big privacy questions that come up with the story. You know, today people take cells for use in research all the time, and you would never attach a person's name to them like her cells were. And I think, you know, so initially some people think, well, that's because they're hiding something, but it's actually about, usually about medical record privacy more than anything else.
Ben, hold on, since you said you were going to pledge, it's great. Somebody here will pick up the line and take your pledge, and I appreciate you calling in this show. It means a great deal. We never know who's listening and family members are there, but I'm going to read something before we go to break here to give you a sense of the book, if I might, if you don't mind, Rebecca.
Sure, go ahead.
And it comes out of this what you're talking about right now. And it was where you wrote about Michael Gold, who wrote the article for Science 85 magazine, about Walter Nelson Reese's campaign to stop the contamination of the cells they had taken from Henrietta Lacks. And it was called A Conspiracy of Cells, One Woman's Immortal Legacy, and the Medical Scandal It Caused. And this is what you wrote. And you're a wonderful writer, so it's easy to read what you write here. You're talking about Deborah, the daughter. She found a photo of Henrietta, hands on hips, at the front of the book and her name at the end of the first chapter. Then she read the passage out loud to herself, shaking with excitement. They were all the cells of an American who in her entire life had probably not been more than a few miles from her home in Baltimore, Maryland. Her name was Henrietta Lacks. In the 10-page chapter that followed, Gold quoted extensively from her medical records, the blood spotting on her underwear, the syphilis, her rapid decline. No one in Henrietta's family had ever seen those medical records, let alone anyone at Hopkins' permission to release them to a journalist for publication in a book the whole world would read. Then, without warning, Deborah turned the pages of Gold's book and stumbled on the details of her mother's demise. Excruciating pain, fever, and vomiting, poisons that building in her blood, a doctor writing, quote, discontinue all medication and treatment except analgesics, end quote, and the records of Henrietta's body during the autopsy. And I'll finish with this. The dead woman's arms had been pulled up and back so that the pathologist could get her at her chest. The body had been split down the middle and opened wide. Grayish-white tumor globules filled the corpse. It looked as if the inside of the body was studded with pearls. Strings of them ran over surfaces of the liver, diaphragm, intestine, appendix, rectum, and heart. Thick clusters were heaped on top of the ovaries and fallopian tubes. The bladder area was the worst, covered by a solid mass of cancerous tissue. After reading that passage, Deborah fell apart. She spent days and nights crying, imagining the pain Henrietta must have been in. And I could read more because this book is so moving and so powerful.
Powerful book.
And we're going to bring some of that to some conclusion about what this book means for all of us and why we need to really understand this story and what Henrietta Lacks meant and, as importantly, what Rebecca Skloot has brought to America for us to wrestle with and what we learned from this. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Rebecca Skloot talking about her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
En las multitudes el hombre que yo amo, gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído que en todo su ancho graba noche y día. Grillos y canarios, martillos, turbinas, ladridos, chubascos y la voz tan tierna de mi bien amado. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el sonido y el abecedario, con él las palabras que pienso y declaro, padre, amigo, hermano, y luz alumbrando la ruta del alma del que estoy amando. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado la marcha de mis pies cansados. Con ellos anduve ciudades y charcos, playas y desiertos, montañas y llanos, y la casa tuya, tu calle y tu patio. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio el corazón que agita su marco.
And Anthony and I are talking with
Rebecca Skloot. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And this story, Mark, is fascinating to me. Rebecca, as we were reading over the last couple of days, we were so... First of all, I'm not sure if you've read some of the reviews of the book. Because I think everyone, almost universally, just loves your writing style. It really does. You almost feel like you are an observer in these rooms that you take us through. Whether it's Clover, Virginia, whether it's Hopkins, whether it's East Baltimore. And this is the part I want to ask you about. There is a long legacy in this country. You touch on so many things in this book of African-American cynicism, fear, and skepticism about research and medicine. And there's some valid reasons for that kind of skepticism. We talk about it on the periphery a lot on our shows, Mark, about why African-Americans are really skeptical about some medical tests and why we should be involved in them. But you really give us a detailed emotional history about the Tuskegee experiments and other things that happened over time. Talk to us a little bit about that and why it was important for you to include that history in this book.
Oh, it's so important. You know, there is this long history of research on African Americans without consent, and a lot of it's a very painful history that has really built an incredible mistrust between African Americans and scientific research in general. And the story of Henrietta Lacks has always been part of that. As the first caller said, you know, this is a story that his family had been sort of passing down over the generations. So people who know about the story, people around Hopkins, you know, they've been telling this story for years. And, you know, the oral history tradition, one of the things that happens is a lot of the really sort of bad history has led people to think with the Henrietta Lacks story, you know, maybe the scientist gave her cancer. You know, she was a seemingly healthy 30-year-old woman who went to the hospital and then died really quickly. And so people wondered, did doctors give her cancer? Did they not treat her cancer so that these cells would grow? And so there was actually quite a bit of misinformation out there, as well as a, you know, just lack of the basic story. And that, you know, it fed this fear surrounding medical research. So one of the things that I really wanted to do was tell, you know, what did and didn't happen, in a sense, mm-hmm. to sort of, you know, set the record straight and say, yeah, you know, race did play an important role in the story. But, you know, it's often been held up, the scientist who grew the cells has been held up as this racist scientist who did awful things to her, and he didn't. You know, she got the standard treatment of the day. And so I wanted to sort of dispel some of the myths while putting the story out there so that it could be part of this larger discussion about how do we get over this fear and this really difficult history so that African Americans can be part of research in a healthy way so that they can benefit from the science, which, you know, they often don't now.
And I also, this the significance of this, I think, to get people a sense of the almost contradiction and the pain between the family and the events that took place. What her cells actually did for humanity.
Oh, yeah.
And let's just start with that. To talk about what her cells did for humanity.
Oh, it's almost impossible to really sort of give a full scale sense of it. They've done so much. Going into the scientific databases where they publish, they put scientific papers and things like that. If you go onto one of those and you type HeLa, it's like going on Google and typing and. You just get thousands and thousands and thousands of hits. And, it's everything from the polio vaccine and gene mapping and in vitro fertilization to, you know, our most important cancer drugs, treatments for Parkinson's. You know, the list just goes on and on. And one of the things that's been so hard for her family is that, you know, in some ways, everyone has benefited off of these cells in some way or another. People who've gotten vaccines, taken drugs. And her family, you know, they don't have health insurance to this day. They can't go to the doctor. And they sort of feel like everyone's benefited from them, and they've actually suffered as a result of the cells. So the imbalance there in access to care and sort of the benefits that her family has seen is pretty stark.
And given that, I mean, where do you think? I just kept thinking about this whole thing. What does this take us about the nature of our health industry, not just the hospital, but the health industry, and what a family like the family of Henry Alex should deserve, should look for in all this?
Yeah, it's a big question. And, you know, one of the first questions I get when I give talks about this is people say, well, so has anybody, you know, have the scientists given the family money? And the answer is that they haven't. And there's a whole sort of debate about that, you know, and whether they should. But the fact that the family doesn't have access to health care, I think, gets at the heart of what's really emotional about the story for a lot of people, because it says so much about our current healthcare system. So much of the future of medicine depends on research on people's cells and genes and tissues that are used in research without people benefiting from them directly. And the thinking has always been, well, in the end, everyone benefits because they advance medicine and they lead to all these important drugs. But in our current system, not everyone does benefit. So the fact that we have this imbalance of access to healthcare in our society, and that the people who end up getting the least access are people of color and, you know, people who are, you know, have no money, you know, that it just raises these big questions about our healthcare system and if anyone should be profiting off of these things. I mean, now they're taking samples from people, often without them really realizing it. Those are being used in research that's then, in some cases, commercialized and turned into drugs that are then sold back to people, and a lot of people can't afford them. So it's sort of a part of a bigger question about how...
It's a huge question, and an interesting one to explore one day, maybe on the air with you and some others.
Absolutely.
I mean, you raise the issue in the year afterward when you talk about the debate over commercialization of human biological material. Always comes to one fundamental point. Like it or not, we live in a market-driven society, and science is part of the market. But the question is, who should benefit from that? Should it just be those who take the tissues and the cells, or should it be those from whom they were taken?
Right, exactly. And or anyone, you know, and a lot of this is tax dollar funded research. So it's also, in addition to using samples from people, relying on biological, like raw materials from people, it's also using tax dollars from people. So, it's part of it, you know, and there have been lawsuits about this. And in the end, nothing has really been settled over it, in part because the scientists fear that any change in the way it's done now would interfere with science. And, you know, it's pretty clear that that's not, like, people are, there is going to have to be some level of change and discussion. And if nothing else, disclosure. You know, there's nothing right now that requires scientists to say, you know, I'm going to use this tissue in research and I may profit off of it, you are not. So there's not even a requirement for disclosure at this point, which a lot of people... Really, when it comes down to it, I think a lot of people just want to know what's going on.
Rebecca Skloot, this has been just a great talking to you. We look forward to having you on as a guest in some other discussions, and looking forward to meeting you in October when you're in Baltimore and having you back on the air.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Thank you so
beautiful,
much for the book.
Beautiful, powerful story.
That was Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, as we remember Henrietta Lacks on the day she passed away. We have to take a very brief break, but please don't go away. When we come back, you'll hear a panel discussion I moderated last weekend at the Baltimore Book Fair. So please, stay with us.
I'd like to do a song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? That's it.